Okay, GarageBand, you are going. And we're talking about surgical nursing. Good, you're still going? Great, are you down there? Okay, surgeries are done in the hospital, but they're also now done often in surgery centers, outpatients. Anybody had any experience with outpatient surgery? What is that? Yeah. Actually, that's a little different. Same day surgery is when you're admitted the same day that you have the surgery. You may have an extended hospital stay afterwards. Outpatient surgery is when there's no hospital admission. There's a slight little difference there. So outpatient surgery. What's being done outpatient? Yes. Cataracts. Yeah. Did you have that? Your mom did it? Yeah, cataracts are done outpatient a lot. Even more elaborate things like cholecystectomies, gallbladder operations, are being done outpatient, believe it or not. Tonsillectomies are being done outpatient. Why do you think there's a trend to outpatient surgeries right now? I mean, I have seen this huge just in the last 5 years. The number of surgeries in outpatient has like quadrupled in the just in the last few years. Why do you think that is?
Technology is improving, the incisions are
smaller. Excellent. Yes, technology is improving. We are doing a lot of laparoscopic surgeries. What's it going to be, a laparoscopic and open surgery? Any ideas?
Isn't
it like
they just have the different holes and then
the
smaller incisions
in
the machine
and the other ones? Exactly.
She
said smaller incisions in the machine swimming, yes.
Is that like
the surgery? Okay. Often they are done laparoscopically. Not always. But we can't say every gallbladder is always done, ACL repairs are always done laparoscopically. But often these days, if not most of the time. Okay, yeah. Definitely. And what does that do, that fact that we're just making four little holes in the abdomen to get to the gallbladder? They're even doing total hysterectomies, transvaginal. Okay? Got that? Put that in your brain. That's kind of hard to visualize. They're taking out complete uteruses without ever cutting anybody open. They've been doing TURPS, transurethral resection of the prostate surgeries through the urethra for a number of years now. So yes, technology is growing. Surgical competencies are improving. The techniques are improving. The technology to have the cameras to go in and be able to do that, yes, is enabling laparoscopic surgery, which is wonderful. Laparoscopic surgery, four little holes compared to one big incision. What's the advantage there? Heals faster. What else? A scarring, yes. Yeah, biggie, less chance of infection, yes. The biggest problem post-surgically is infection.
Is it
laparoscopic? Laparoscopic is the phrase, laparoscopic surgery. Okay. There's one other thing that you would like to just say, actually, that the morning class said first. Yes, it's a lot cheaper, right? Money is huge. Your insurance may pay for a laparoscopic cholecystectomy, but you better have a really good reason if you're going to have it open. Because obviously what happens is they're cutting open your whole abdomen. I think you need to stay in the hospital for at least a day or two, don't you? What are the chances of infection? Not only from the surgery itself, but what happens when you stay in the hospital? What lives in hospitals? Tons of bugs. And what are those called? Infections that we would get post-surgically in the hospital? Mm-hmm. Those are colonial infections. Insurance companies aren't paying for them much these days. So who picks up the tab for another colonial infection? It's the hospital. They certainly don't want to do that. So lots of reasons that we're moving towards outpatient surgery. The complexity of surgery certainly has a lot to do with it. A more complex surgery is not going to be done outpatient. Recovery time generally is much quicker. Yes, ma'am?
So you said outpatient surgery is just, like, you don't stay
You don't stay. It's in a surgery center. You come and you have the procedure done and you leave. Versus same-day surgery, which is when you come into the hospital that morning, have the surgery that day, and then stay in the hospital and recover. So there's a slight difference between outpatient surgery and same-day surgery. So that's the first difference. All right? Recovery time is less, or surgeries with shortened recovery times, because possibly they're laparoscopic and not that complex, are good candidates for outpatient surgeries. And expected level of care post-op. Okay? So if you're going to have a hip replacement, chances are that's not going to ever be done outpatient because of the amount of care that someone needs when they can't walk. Okay? So that these are all the considerations that we take into account. Here's some examples. This morning was class was asking what a DNC was. Anybody know? I think it stands for dilatation and curettage. They dilate the cervix and scrape the inside of the uterus, commonly done after a miscarriage, and there might be some fetal tissue left. There are other reasons why you have a DNC, but that's a very common one. It's kind of a... Yes, a DNC is, I think it's dilation and curettage. You have to look it up, and I may be slightly off on that. But the idea is to dilate the cervix, clean up the inside of the uterus. I don't know if it's actually done scraping these days or maybe other mechanisms, but that's sort of the term. Commonly done after miscarriage, for any reason, if there's tissue in the uterus, it needs to be any, sometimes other foreign bodies, some, you know, might have that. Okay, hemorrhoidectomy, we're going to talk a little bit about hemorrhoidectomy later in the afternoon. We talked pretty much about all the advantages, right? Cost, hospital-acquired infection, patient's routine is less compromised, less time lost from work, and less physiological stress, right? How much sleep do our hospital patients get? It's a huge stressful experience to be in the hospital. Who wants to do that? Right? Much more comfortable to be at home if you can do that. So physical care is provided in the same way as far as the physical work that we as caregivers give. But obviously if someone's going to have the surgery this outpatient and then go home, the need for teaching is great, right? Really great. And more and more people are being sent home with some rather complex things. My 14-year-old son had a minor urinary surgery and was sent home with a catheter. 14 years old, and they sent him home with a catheter in my care. Oh, your mom's a nurse, she can take it out. I so wanted to take him back to the hospital and have some other nurse do it. I mean, does that seem right to you?
No.
That's why I said to the doc, who was a friend of mine. And I'm going, what are you thinking? Yeah. But actually, my son was really gracious about it. I was probably much more uncomfortable than he was. He was very cool about it. And it was no big deal. You can take a catheter without really seeing anything. Just deflate the balloon and go, and it's all out. And he was great. My son was just really great. But this is the same child that gave me like blow by blow updates on his pubescent development when he was 13 and 14. He's really out there, gap. That is not the one that's here, by the way, as a student. This is his older brother. The one that's here is very complete. Don't talk to him about this. But my older son, he would laugh about it. But so that's just an example of, they send people home with catheters for a family member to take out. Ooh, okay. But this is the kind of thing we're doing, hence the need for more education, right? And who are the educators? Of course. It's us again. We have all these wonderful hats that we wear. I just found out now my patient needs 2 liters of packed red blood cells. Anybody know how to get packed red blood cells delivered to the house? But the doctor, he comes in last night and he writes 2 liters of packed red blood cells and says, we can do a transfusion. I went, we're going to take him to my dress. He goes, no, you can do it here. And I said, well, I can't. I mean, like, I'm physically comfortable with the procedure. And then he goes, okay, then he writes 2 liters of packed red blood cells as soon as possible. Okay, now I get to do all the nutrition to get home. I'm going to have 2 liters of packed red blood cells delivered to the house at the appropriate time with all the equipment when I'm there. So see what nurses get themselves into? You know, we're teachers, we're, supply people now.
You never know. It's always very exciting. So I'll be able to report to you if anybody needs red blood cells delivered to their home. I'll be able to. I'll know how to do that by next week. Three phases of the operation. Pre-op. That's before the operation starts, right? How long is preoperative phase? How long is preoperative phase? Anybody? Any ideas? How long before the surgery is pre-op phase? Okay. What do you think? Did anybody read the book? Maybe, or look at the book? A little bit? Absolutely, it does depend on the urgency of the surgery. The pre-op phase begins when the decision is made to have the surgery. So that may be when they enter the hospital, that may be when they come into the ER and we've got 1 minute to get them prepped and under, right? It may be my brother's loose body is in his shoulder that he planned for 6 months to have the surgery. He entered the preoperative phase when the doctor said, hey, you got this loose body in your shoulder, we should really take him out. He said, is it going to be it's a pain over what we do. He said, great, I'll do it for my vacation in 6 months. And that he entered the pre-op phase when that decision was made. So he was in pre-op for 6 months. Or seconds, literally. Right? Intraoperative. Now you got it. Intraoperative is? When they're admitted to the OR. When they go, generally it's downstairs in the OR. What about post-op? What do you think? Surgery's over. Where'd they go? You're missing one little slice. PACU. Yes. What you said? PACU. They go to the PACU. Post-anesthesia care unit. All right. And then we decide where they go. After that. They may go to ICU or back to the floor. Okay? PACU. 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 Post-anesthesia care unit. PACU. Okay. So what happens pre-op? I think I have some slides on this. Pre-op. Decision for surgery is made. Pre-op, that's when it starts. When it ends, when the patient is transferred to the operating room. What are the nursing responsibilities in there? What happens? What do we have to do during that time? Any ideas? What do we do? Pardon me? Labs. Excellent. We do lots of labs. Yeah, we send lots of blood, right? What else? You bet. A fresh set of vitals right before they leave the floor. Good. Yes. Right. Or any food at all, right? MPO for generally 24 hours, sometimes just overnight. Why are we not going to feed them? Is there anesthesia? So what happens to the intestinal protocol? Stalsis. It stops.
Is that for any kind of surgery? Like,
again,
if they're having a knee surgery, but they're doing it to sleep, it's still...
Right, because it's the anesthesia that does it. Now, if they can do the knee surgery in the local, they're doing it. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty good. And, yeah, when it's emergency, you would not worry about that and put them under the yes. That would be the next question that I would have to somebody in the audience that needs to have their spleen right there. We put them under the yes. But it was a nice planned surgery, yeah. What's the other thing we need to do as nurses before they go to surgery? All this is good. What else? Yes. A physical, yeah, absolutely. We do an assessment before they go. What?
To make sure that they're all right.
Oh, to gauge their anxiety level. Yeah, that's very good. And what do we do in that case? Let's say they are very anxious, as many of us would be. Particularly those of us who know something about surgery would be particularly anxious to really assess. you with one bucket, yeah. And I personally would ask for some anxiety meds. And you as a nurse might want to facilitate that for your patient. Okay. Make sure you do that.
You're missing one very, very important thing.
Documentation. You write everything down. This goes with documentation. Yeah. Yeah, that all happens actually just a little later. But you would assume, yes, that would be part of what you would do, sure. But there, that happens formally anyway. Informed consent, right? Okay. Informed consent. How does that work for surgery? You know, can we just take anybody we like, put them under, and take them to surgery? I don't think so. Now, it is the surgeon's responsibility to explain the risks and benefits of the surgery. Now, does that mean the nurse has no role in that? In reality, what often happens is the surgeon comes in, explains the risks and benefits, hands the consent to the nurse and says, you know, make sure it's signed. Nurse's commitment, and that's fine, and leaves. And then you as a nurse go into your patient and say, I see Dr. Smith was in. Any questions or concerns? What did he say? How many times does that happen? So, again, physicians are not trained to be good communicators. They are trained in eradicating disease, right, and in medications. Whose job is it to do the communication and the holistic work of making sure that the patient is comfortable and understands? Us, yet again, yes. Or it's fine blood or whatever else we need to do. Us again. And we just, that's kind of cool about our job. We have so many different things we need to do. I have no idea how to get blood to a house. Absolutely, I don't have a clue. That's going to be a little bit of an adventure for me. I'm going to learn how that happens. Is it even legal? I mean, I have no idea. I have all these questions about it. But I have all the 24 hours to figure out. Okay. So we'll see. But yeah, they'll ask questions of us, of course. What happens if then the patient is not satisfied with your answers? What course of action do you have open to you? Where they go, really? That's what I have? I'm not too sure about that. That's what they're going to do? I don't know. Yeah. So at that point, I call the surgeon back in and say, Mrs. Jones is not real comfortable. Can you come back and talk to her? Can't you just talk with her? I did, but you really need to come and see this patient before tomorrow morning. So sometimes we advocate for our patients in that manner. They need more education. She needs. So, and then they get transferred to the operating room, and and often at Mount Sinai they have what they call a boarding pass. But at every hospital they have some kind of checklist where all these things we've talked about and more are going to be on the checklist. Hopefully you'll be able to see that boarding pass this semester as your patient or one patient on your floor goes off to surgery. So then they go into what? Generally there's a holding area down very near the surgical arena that's staffed with more nurses. At that point, they just kind of wait until the OR is free for them. Sometimes they can go right in. Sometimes they're in kind of a holding area. Their anxiety at that point is very high. They will, generally. Often, the anesthesiologist will come visit. Again, that's another opportunity to ask for the anti-anxiety meds. And sometimes a family can go with them at that point. But you, as your nurse, would probably stay in the med-surg room. But you, as a student, if your patient's going to surgery, you'll be able to experience all this. If your patient is going to surgery, go. You know, talk to your clinical instructor, have them do whatever they need to do. Someone mentioned diagnostic tests. Yeah, lots of them. Okay. What do you think would be particularly important prior to surgery? Any ideas? What would be important? Blood counts, right? Yeah, blood, yeah. You take blood, do all basic panels. Right. There's one specific blood test that's of the utmost importance. Any ideas? Platelets, yeah, and basically clotting time. You don't care if you want to make sure it's enough platelets, but maybe there's enough platelets and there's a problem with the clotting cascade, there's factors missing. We want to make sure they clot. PT and PTT. Prothrombin and PP. It's on our list here. Prothrombin time. and thrombin time. So it's PT and prothrombin and PTT. PTT, two different tests that are done that will give us an idea of the coagulation. All right? How long does blood take to coagulate? If it takes a long time, that means there's more of a chance of them bleeding out, right? What patients might you see having long coagulation times, high PT and PTTs? People with thrombocytopenia, what else? People who don't. Yeah, people on anticoagulants. We don't have blood thinning, we have anticoagulants. Big words, that okay? Yeah, people, and can you, do you know any anticoagulants? Aspirin is one, sure, aspirin's one. What else? What else can you think of any? Do you know of any? I don't expect you to, I don't know, just. Coumadin is a biggie, all right? A lot of cardiac patients are on Coumadin. It's, yeah, an anticoagulant. And why would a cardiac patient be on that? If they're stroke patients, we're concerned about strokes, all right? We're concerned about the blood clotting. People with problems with atrial fib are usually on atrial fibrillation, are often on Coumadin. Many cardiac patients are on Coumadin. They have to stop it 2 weeks before, or else what kind of risk are we going to have in the OR? Excessive bleeding, right? Yeah, and that can be huge, particularly if you're doing an open surgery. It can be huge. Ideally, we stop it. Can we always? No. When these people get an automobile accident, we bring them right in, we do our best. But that would be something that the nurse would be responsible for. Was the Coumadin stopped 2 weeks ahead? Did you educate your patient? Do they know why? All right. If not, we'd plug them through, give them a lot of vitamin K and hope for the best. Another clap. So this is a nice demo test of tests, and it's in your text too. HNH, some adequate hemoglobin, we're looking at the oxygen carrying capacity of the red blood cells as well as the number of red blood cells. Real important, right? Yeah, how's the oxygen going to get around for healing? White blood cell count, is there an infection? Is something going on? It's very important that people with high infections not go to surgery. You can spread the infection. I worked in OB for a while, and I remember one of the first deliveries I saw, the woman spiked a fever literally minutes before that baby was going to be born. Just, I mean, like 20 minutes before she should be at the very end of labor. We started pumping her through antibiotics, but we couldn't stop the labor at that point. So the baby was born and was immediately rushed to the PACU, not the PACU, but a NICU, because she had an infection that she contracted from her mother's blood at the very last part of her intrauterine life. So it's a big deal, okay? So we really don't want people going into surgery with infections, because we can spread that all over their bodies, besides the fact that they won't have the white blood cells, the strength to combat all the problems from surgery, right? Because there's a lot of healing that has to go on. So we might want to look at their albumin. That'll tell us how much protein they have, how their diet's been. For definitely electrolytes, right? Certainly electrolytes. Want to look at serum creatinine, blood nitrogen, okay, all that. We want to look at how are the kidneys working. It's all going to show us how the body's working, how is it going to handle the surgery, and how fast are they going to recover. Do they have everything they need to recover? Basically. All right. So we're going to give sedation, for sure. Okay? We're going to sedate them. That's different from anesthesia. Anesthesia is a peristalsis. There's going to be a sedation. We want to reduce their anxiety. We're going to induce amnesia so they can't remember. There's a whole cocktail of drugs that people have as they go into surgery. And ask the anesthesiologist about this when you're there. What are you giving? And so people truly don't remember any of their surgeries. They're not supposed to. Occasionally somebody will. And maybe that's why sometimes you do get very casual OIs, like the laryngeal spasms. I don't know if they're dancing around. I think it'd be kind of cool. Okay. Most everybody gets some kind of gastric acid reducing medication. Why would this be important? And you'll see this in your hospitalized patients too. Almost everyone is on some kind of gastric acid neutralizing med. You're laying down, so people are at a high risk for esophageal reflux. So the gastric acid can, or as part of the when we anesthetize the whole GI tract, which we do because the body's anesthetized, it's easy for that solution to like switch back up the esophagus. We don't want stomach acids up in the esophagus. It can be really dangerous. They can burn. They can cause ulcers. So we just neutralize them. And you'll see this as you're going over your meds for your first patient. Many, many are on some kind of gastric acidity reducing medications. What else? What else do we have? There's some more examples. Okay, that you might use. It's extremely important to ask your patient about medications they're taking, right? And again, this is the nurse's job. So although sure, we have the whole list of meds that they normally take that are prescribed by a physician, that may not be all, correct? Like someone said aspirin, yeah, aspirin. It's a heavy-duty anticoagulant. Okay, if someone takes a lot of aspirin for headaches, for knee pain, whatever, they don't, that's over the counter, they don't mention it, and then we wonder why they're not blood supplying. And we give them a test, and we've wasted 4 days in the hospital waiting for them to get the clotting factor up. Illegal drugs, again, people may state that they use them, but they often minimize them. Even legal drugs like alcohol, people often minimize the amount that they drink. Do you drink? Oh, yeah, a glass of wine with dinner. Well, they have two screwdrivers, two glasses of wine with dinner, and at least two afterwards. Okay, what are we worried about this kind of person? What are we concerned about going to surgery? Let's say it's some middle-aged man from Sonoma County. What are we going to be worried about him going in for a hip replacement with that kind of drinking? Although he says a glass of wine or so a day. Long term, yeah. Strictly for the OR experience. What are we worried about? He's coming for a hip replacement. He may go through withdrawal, right? That's a heck of a lot of alcohol. We'll talk about that in our next lecture. He may go through withdrawal. What else? People may not be responsive to pain meds as we expected because of these other chemicals in their body, right? So that's going to throw us. You know, so we may have to give them a lot more pain meds and wonder why. Why? So that's all important. Herbal medications, vitamins, what do they do that might be a problem? Pardon? They sure can interfere with some drugs. They can also be anticoagulants as well. So what are you taking? So often the patient will come in to the hospital, tell the admitting nurse all the medications they're taking, then as you're visiting with them and talking to them, you find out about four more that are important. But just kind of come out and talk. And it's not because they're trying to be deceptive. It truly is because they really didn't think it was important. So again, nursing responsibility, all these things. What about diabetics? Diabetics take some special care. We do withhold insulin. They are an MPO, so we have to monitor that serum glucose levels. Absolutely, extremely important. What are they going to do without their insulin? Well, they're not eating either, so where are they going to be? We commonly give them dextrose in water. So we come with their IV hydration is often dextrose, so you're getting low sugar. We have to watch them closely. So a diabetic patient, we have additional concerns. And then we withhold the insulin. So we're going to have intraoperative meds. We talked a little bit about your pre-op meds. You might want to give some anti-anxiety or request that for your patient. We give general anesthesia or regional anesthesia. The anesthetist is in charge of this, or the certified nurse anesthetist. All right? Certified registered nurse anesthetist. And that was the laryngospasms. That's what they are. They're a nurse anesthetist school. So they are nurses. So they're studying to be, basically do the work of an anesthesiologist. They're called nurse anesthetists. There is one other role for, advanced practice role for a nurse in the OR. It's called RN first assist. whereas that nurse basically performs basic, uncomplicated surgical procedures, such as a cholecystectomy, tonsillectomy, biopsies. So know that that's another avenue of advanced practice that is very much open to you. Kind of cool. So if you fall in love with surgery, that might be something you might want to consider. RN first assist. And if you look it up online, it does require, right now, amazingly enough, it does not require a master's degree. It simply requires a certain time in the OR, licensure or certification as an OR nurse, as well as sitting for exams, a few extra anatomy classes. So right now, before they make it a master's prepared profession, it might be good to move on with it. I haven't seen it too much in California. My guess is it's not going to be too much in California. It'll be more rural areas. Underserved areas. You can see a lot more nurse first assist. All right, so we do all this. We give post. Okay, so now your patient has all this in the OR, right? They're out of it. They're anesthetized. They're not feeling a thing. Okay, so the RN on the floor was responsible for them, correct? You on the RN on the floor did the checklist. You got them on the gurney. Transport's taking them down to that little holding area. They will meet another RN who then accepts the patient. That RN is then responsible for them until they walk through the OR, into the OR room. Sometimes there's not that holding. Okay, in there you're going to find the circulating nurse, right? And there may be another nurse. There will definitely be the surgeon, the anesthesiologist. You're going to have a scrub tech. Okay, generally that's not a nurse. The person who's going to glare at you, or as you, if you even glance at the table with all the surgical equipment on it. All right. The person in charge is the surgeon. They're the ones who call it. But before they start the surgery, the nurse is going to say, time out. And it's literally time out. Everybody stops, gives the nurse their attention, and the nurse says, we are doing a bypass on Mr. Jones. We give a brief history. And everybody with us, are we all on the same page? Is this Mr. Jones? Looks like it is. Okay. So there's that time out, and that's relatively new. It's to be assured that everyone's where they're supposed to be. You're in the right surgery. You know, you're not accidentally taking out, doing hysterectomy on a 23-year-old woman just because you got her mixed up with the surgery you're supposed to go into the next door. Okay? Which has happened. So it's real clear. Where are we? Who are we working on? Who are you, meaning the team, and what are we doing? Yeah.
Also getting the right side.
Getting the correct side. It's a huge deal. And often you even have a patient right on their leg, this knee with an arrow. Okay, no, I'm serious. I mean, because whatever possible mistake you can think of has happened. All right? When you're in the OR, watch the nurse. Nurses are in charge of keeping track of everything in the OR. They are the record keepers. How many sponges do we use? I was witness to a very interesting case on the med search floor a few years ago where there was a sponge left in an individual. We could not figure out why this man was not recovering from surgery. He was having infection after infection. We didn't know what was going on. There was a surgical sponge left in him. We went in, took it out. Do you think they ever told the guy? Never told him. Just come out. Yeah. They just said there was a complication. We need to go in and see what's going on. Which there was. They didn't say it was nosocomial. Or is that, in this case, iatrogenic, right?
Yeah.
Big time.
Can you not find
this was one of, I've seen a couple times when things were really not done correctly, and this is one of them. I was there with students. So when I arrived on the floor, and the manager calls me to her office, I'm like, oh, God, who's screwed up now? She calls me and she says, none of you students can mention anything about this, but I want to tell you so that you can make sure to tell your students not to say anything. Yeah. Watch for it.
Was it like an extra lecture?
finding someone to talk to you.
So who's responsible for
the surgeon?
The surgeon.
Well, the surgeon is the one in charge of the OR.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, it would trickle down to every single person that was there. Would be liable for sin. Absolutely. And in cases like this, yeah, generally when a lawsuit like this comes about, they sue everybody who's present. But it's not uncommon for them to exclude the nice nurse. I said, not Betty Jo, she was so kind. That's just not, I know she had anything. And I've seen lawsuits like that, you know, maybe 25 names. But you're thinking, what about this nurse? She was there like all the time. Well, that's wrong, because she's so nice. Or she was so good to us. So be a really nice nurse, and maybe they won't see you too. And it's like, you really have to be the one on duty, you know? But you're still named. In that case, know that the hospital is carrying malpractice insurance on our staff. So that would be a time when that would kick in, and it would be handled off in the hospital. Because you're just one of the names on the list. But no, in this case, the patient never knew. We took it out, he recovered, he went all around on with his life, and it's all kind of under the record. And so, yes, that kind of thing still happens. Absolutely. Okay, so we get the intraop. All right, now your patient's in surgery, they've under anesthetic, successful surgery. Now, know that in the surgical arena, DNRs are not valid. Remember what DNR is? They're withheld. Okay. Do not resuscitate orders are suspended in the surgical arena. Why? Why does that make sense? Right, when it gets refixed, and we basically do all sorts of life-supporting measures while people are under anesthesia, don't we? So if you have a DNR that says no life-supporting measures, that's really paradoxical. So DNRs are suspended in surgery, which is why you see a lot of deaths in the PACU. Because we'll keep them alive, and then we know very well they can't sustain life on their own. We keep alive with the machines that are in surgery, they go to PACU and they die. That's not uncommon. People do die in surgery, sure. Massive bleeding, all that kind of thing. More commonly in the PACU post. So what's our goal of the PACU? Do I have it? Pain, right? Let's talk to pain. We're not going to avoid it. It's huge. So in the PACU staff, which is right next door to the OR, hopefully do have a chance to check out the PACU. It's not very exciting because all that's going on there is people are recovering. They're coming out of their anesthesia. We're dealing with the pain big time. So the nurses there are watching their vitals. They're watching that they're breathing, that they're coming out of the anesthesia, that they're making the transition out of the OR, out of that unconscious state, that they're breathing, and they try to hydrate and minimize the pain. It's not uncommon for the anesthesiologist to come in, check, make some adjustments on the pain meds, whatever they need. Remember, you learned in pharmacology, everyone's very different in their response to pain, aren't they? People are truly different in how much they feel pain. So that's not just a psychological thing. For instance, redheads, we don't have any redheads in here. Redheads are extremely susceptible to medications and extremely susceptible to pain. They're generally very, very fair skin, so their skin is thinner. So they really hurt more. Right? Which some of that is good because they're much more susceptible to meds. Right? So it all kind of works out. But yeah, they feel more pain. Yes?
Is it true that the patient can ask for as much pain as they should?
Pretty much. You, and this brings us to our kind of pain assessment things that we were talking about as well. Today, you are responsible for giving pain meds. I mean, it's in your hands completely. And you can bring your own ethical feelings to that job. I worked with a nurse once that would not give any pain meds to an AIDS patient because she didn't approve of his lifestyle. I couldn't believe it. I said, oh, your patient is still asking for meds. She goes, I know, you think I'm giving him any? And I went in and I didn't. So, yeah, I couldn't believe that I would run into such prejudice in this day. Actually, it was about 10 years. But still, I cannot believe that anybody would say that. Other nurses say, no, I'm not going to maintain this. They're drug-seeking. Well, very likely. And the decisions are ours as nurses. We have that power, which is very frightening. The physicians often write pages of medications that you can get for pain. And you get to choose. You can overdose on that. When you go in the hospitals, take a look. Look at this. Look at all the meds that are available to us to give PRN as you need the pain. They're lengthy, extensive, post-op. So you need to know what you're doing for pain meds. Hopefully you'll start developing that knowledge this semester. And your ethics and morals and values are going to come into play. My personal take is I will liberally give pain meds because prescribing the medications is not my job. My job is to make the patient comfortable. And I will do whatever it takes to do that within the guidelines I'm given by the medical doctor whose job is to prescribe the meds. So I'm going to have faith in my colleague that he or she has prescribed a reasonable amount of options for me to implement, and I'm going to use it. But that's my thing. You're in control as a nurse. So watch how nurses on the floor do this. What do? How do they handle it? Do you see some prejudices coming out? You will. They're drug-seeking. I'm not going to give them any. They're just drug-seeking. I don't care if they're drug-seeking. They're still in pain. For me, that's me. But again, that's my personal take. You may feel completely fine. So post-op pain, unavoidable, but we do our very best. So they're stable, they're out of pain, or they're not out of pain, but the pain is controlled. So now they either go to the ICU or back to the med-surg floor. So you will see fresh post-ops coming back to the med-surg floor. Right? And then we care for them, don't we? Okay, so pain obviously does all those things. Another thing we want to do post-op is make sure they're breathing and their lungs stay clear. So what are we going to use for that, besides coughing and breathing and all that? In sensus veronator, very good. That's a great thing for students to do. Okay. I like to do this. Okay. Medications, of course, non-pharmacological approaches. What are you going to do with that? It's a non-pharmacological approach. You've given your morphine, if it's not going to take effect because it was PO, what are you going to do for your patient for the next half hour, 45 minutes? Pardon? Distraction is great. You're better than TV, actually. You're more interested. And since you're a student, you can do that. What else? What's it going to do? Huh? Music is good. Visualization. And visualization doesn't have to be that hokey, oh, let's go to a nice quiet place. No. You could just say, where'd you go on your last vacation? Oh, you went to the mountains. Oh, I bet you sat by a beautiful stream. Was it water blue? Did you see the light coming off it? Was it cool? Put your hand in, You can go into it without so much of it. Let's do some visualization. You can kind of move them into it more gently. Don't show up. All right? It doesn't have to be like a heavy-duty kind of, cosmic deal, right? So try your non-pharmacological approaches. My patient that I'm going to be sharing with you, I hope throughout the semester, we'll see. My boyfriend says he thinks I'm going to fall apart and be an absolute mess when he dies. I went to his home at 5 this morning because he had a fever and his heart rate was really accelerated. And I sensed that, I've been getting real anxious. The night nurse I had on hadn't been with him much, and I was a little nervous about that. So I went in, and I just talked to him, and I told you just be, right? Sometimes you just are there. There's some cool water on his forehead. And I went, what? Well, yesterday, I'd taken cool water and kind of, done like this. I wanted to do that again. So I did a little of this. So I spent, 15 minutes. Okay, he fell asleep. I left. The nurse texted me. His fever had gone down a full degree. His respirations had gone from 120 to 80. It's amazing. I am really learning how dramatic that kind of non-pharmaceutical intervention, how that personal thing can really make a difference, just calming, and some simple interventions like relax, things, okay? So non-pharmacological approaches are very, very important. Okay, you can assess your pain, right? You can look it at him, how much is it? And that brings us to that lovely pain assessment that you may have downloaded, right? I gave it to you mainly because we're going to use it as a part of a little class thing we're going to do now, but also because I hope you use some of those concepts there when you're asking about pain for your patients in the hospital. I don't expect you to take that whole sheet, fill it out, but you might want to stick it in on your clipboard so you know what questions to ask when you assess for pain. All right? So now I have a little thing we can do. Let me stop GarageBand. Okay, GarageBand, you're going to stop for the moment. Oh, good, you recorded. Great. We're going to stop you.